and gentlemen, welcome back. Thank you for joining us here. Henrik with Red Ice TV. Always a pleasure having you with us. Today, we are going to talk about Charles Manson, who, of course, as you know, died at the age of 83 in prison. He was actually narrowly escaping a death sentence. I think a year later, he'd been in prison for 1 year when California actually abolished the death penalty. So he actually lingered for a long time in prison. And it could, frankly, be that if he had died at that point, maybe his martyrdom would have been even greater, so to speak, right? But this is a very interesting story around Manson and who kind of basically engineered him, who created him, what is he a product of, and who is behind him and for what purpose. Those are some of the questions that we're going to try to kind of dig deeper into today and talk about together with Jay Dyer, who's back on the show. Good to have you here, Jay. Always a pleasure. Let's kind of just begin and chit-chat a little bit about this, because there's many facets, many aspects to Manson and kind of what made him into what he is, of course. But the main essence that people should know is that he's not an isolated phenomena that rose out of nowhere. He did what he did, and then he vanished. It seems, for us looking at the evidence, if we both are to speak about what we know about him, but also speculate a little bit at the same time, that he was a product, if you will, of years of experimentation, things that seems to have been initiated actually in London initially. He was dragged into this thing of the process church, which had actually earlier roots in London. And then, of course, he transforms with his first, I think when he's in jail for the first time, he joins Scientology. And there's a time between Scientology and the process of the church. And at some point, he basically begins to transform into this demon, this monster, which manipulates other people to basically do his crime. But how do we understand Charles Manson and what he comes out of, what environment?
You want to understand Manson, buddy? I'll show you Charles Manson, you red eyes and commie ice, red commie ice. I got the brain of a child and the fingers of a monster.
That's how you understand Charles Manson.
A lot of mumbo jumbo, in other words.
red commie ice, but
it's all true.
Popsicle, it's all popsicle, true. Red eyes.
We're all in on it.
He does say that in the interviews. He'll start dancing and he'll say that you're all in on it.
He's definitely high energy when you look at some of the interviews with him, you know.
It's huge. High energy. Huge. Manson's going to be huge.
But why are people sucked into someone like him then? You know, why are people, because he's like, he's the devil, but he's Jesus, and he's like fulfilling all these archetypes where basically people are, for some reason, they're drawn to that. They want that. That we want to be around that, right?
It's been some years since I read in depth into Manson, but I can kind of recall roughly what the basic outline was, is that he grew up very poor. I don't think he had a mother, so he was... or his mother was a prostitute or something to that effect, and he didn't know his father, so there was a lack of, you know, parental guidance, obviously. He ended up in the juvenile delinquent system very early for petty crimes. And the story, I don't know how true this is, but the story is that he would, when he was in Kentucky, if I recall, he would kind of wander around burial mounds. And in Kentucky, there's a lot of Indian burial mounds. So he kind of had this feeling that he was being spoken to by spirits and this kind of stuff. So, but I think that he was probably just kind of crazy early on due to, you know, dysfunctional upbringing. Then he gets into the system, the institutional system by the time he's old enough. I don't remember what his crimes were. And it's there that he's introduced to Scientology, at least the story goes. And if I recall, he achieved the Theta Clear level, which is, I don't know if you know about the Xenu when you're at Theta Clear and the aliens, but maybe it's right below that level. I don't know. But regardless, the analyses of different people is that he seemed to be a different person after this process. So there's some speculation that he might have been used as an experiment. And there actually is documentation in different MKUltra books where they would use prison facilities for experimentation. Dr. Ewan Cameron was involved in this in psychiatric institutes. And Dr. John C. Lilly, actually, I've been reading his book about programming with LSD, and he actually was one of the MKUltra doctors. And he specifically says that the prisons were used. I don't know exactly what prisons were used, but I'm saying that it is possible that that I mean, that's who you're going to experiment on. You're going to experiment on people that have signed themselves over to this, to the system, right? You were talking military people, right? I mean, the military owns you. If you are in federal prison, the prison system owns you. So it's very easy, the psychiatric system, very easy to utilize these people for something like that. Again, I don't know for sure, but this is what people have speculated.
And he
so
was,
then when he comes,
he was,
when
sorry,
he comes out of that prison system, then he wanders, you know, to LA and is involved in the Laurel Canyon scene, which Dave McGowan's written extensively about. And this is kind of the hotbed, the petri dish incubator for the coming hippie revolution. And I think that this is where he's going to play a central role in being one of these figures, a cult of personality figure. This is what you were getting at with the creation of a cult. He is, I believe, a kind of social experiment in terms of, can we use a kind of shamanic, creepy, weirdo figure to be a cult magnet? And that's exactly what you see with Manson.
Yeah, he was, just briefly, from 61 to 1966 at McNeil Island, which is in Washington State, one of these penitentiaries. And, of course, it's years later that he, you know, kills Sharon Tate. Well, again, he, you know, directly apparently didn't, you know, do this, but he convinced his family members to do this for him. But, you know, again, the point is well taken. We don't know what kind of things he went through at that point. We don't know what happened with him during his experimentation with Scientology and the process and all that stuff. And there is some footage. Let's play a little bit of that, actually, him talking about, you know, the process. Let's just listen into this.
Yeah, I was in prison when Dianetics first started. Yeah, 1950. We fought the establishment. The black Muslims were coming in with the Quran on the dark side of the moon, and the Islamic arm of the church and the masonry. I don't know how to put the Masons involved in that. I don't want to get tripped up in with anyone else on any other level. But he come up with Dianetics, 1950. So a lot of the guys were interested in studying the way to process the mind, how to clear your mind from past confusion, how to resurrect the soul and be reborn within your within yourself. So that's where Scientology started. Then they started selling it, and then it got to be the process. And then the church of the last day, the last judgment, I sent some people to England. I couldn't go myself, but I sent some people there to do some certain things to make an effect, to cause an awakening of an awareness in that. No, Bruce was just one person that went in that direction. There were some other people riding motorcycles that was doing some other things, you know.
Anyway, he goes on, but that's interesting. I mean, that sets, you know, the process of the church of the final judgment. You have people like De Grimstone and you know, Robert De Grimstone, and that's early in the process, and they're experimenting with all these different ways. And as I said, it's like how to take control of the mind or clean the mind, or, you know, a lot of weird stuff. I mean, I'm not against necessarily like this kind of soul experimentation and like trying to, you know, unlock different properties of yourself. But it's clear that
Uri Geller.
Yeah, exactly. Echo Uri Geller. Bending spoons and all that stuff, you know. No, but I mean, it's clear
can
that
you bend your Viking swords with your mind.
I've not been able to do that yet. I can't even bend it like with my hands. But he, you know, the Grimstone is part of that early process, you know. And as you said, he did this in prison and all that stuff. So, you know, are these the guys we should look at over in London as the kind of the precursor to what happened in the States later with all these other cults that pop up?
Right. If I recall, De Grimstone was a failed Catholic priest. He was considering trying to get into the priesthood. And I think there was some, like, a pederasty case, if I recall. I think that's in William Kennedy's book, Lucifer's Lodge. And then he, together with this woman named, what's her name, Marianne McLean, they create this cult, which is a spinoff of Scientology. And she is directly connected to a prostitution ring that was associated with British spies in terms of the Profumo affair, which is one of the most famous British espionage cases. So the Marianne McLean woman, I think, is very suspicious. And with the British spy circles, you would have a direct connect to the Tavistock Institute because they were specializing in British psychological warfare approaches. And they were the ones studying trauma, shell shock after World War One, and all the stuff that we talked about, you know, a few interviews ago. So what they did was they kind of, I think, kind of put together, like Mr. Potato Head with a cult, like let's stick a Jesus looking beard on the guy. Let's stick a swastika here and, let's put Jesus and Satan together.
Yep.
The same guy. Let's see how that one works, right? Yeah. Like a test tube. But, so, but I think you're absolutely right to pinpoint the connection to, I've not even seen that clip. So that actually backs up my theory that there was a direct, you know, connect to London.
Yeah.
I had no idea Manson talked about that.
Yep. Very interesting. Right. And Berkowitz was also part, I think, Son of Sam, the other killer. He was part of this. I forget the story here. There was, this is detailing some of it on Paranoia Magazine, this article, which is very interesting, which goes into the early Scientology connections between the process Church of the Final Judgment and the Manson family, you know?
Yes, there is a thesis that police investigator Mari Terry posed a long time ago in his book Ultimate Evil, that maybe there was something behind not just Manson, but also Son of Sam, also perhaps Henry Lee Lucas and some of these other cult figures and famous ritual murders that were going on at the time of the explosion of the serial killer phenomenon. It's really Manson that kicks this off in the media sphere. I mean, certainly there have been serial killers before, but Manson kicks this off in the media sphere to initiate the idea of the serial killer. And it's odd because, as you pointed out, Manson himself doesn't actually kill anybody. So he's not technically a serial killer.
Yeah.
He sends his brainwashed girls, his harem, to do it. Harem of assassins. At least so the story goes. But what different writers like Mari Terry, and not just Terry, other people too, have written books on, the possibility that the patterns that pop up in Son of Sam and Berkowitz saying that he was actually part of a group called a family cult, not the same as Manson, but Manson names his cult.
I think I have it. The Children. Was that what the...
That's it. The Children.
The Children, right? Yeah.
That's it. So there's the Children. There's Manson's family. You have the Zodiac at the same time as all this as well.
That's right.
And a lot of people have pointed out that the Zodiac seems to bear a lot of stamps of perhaps military intelligence, naval intelligence, ONI type stuff. That's a thesis. Other writers have posited that these might be murders that were placed upon certain criminals to kind of just clean up unsolved cases. And then certain magazines, certain papers might have cashed in on the fact that, oh, now there's this trending topic of the serial killer. let's create some news stories and sensationalism. So all these factors could be involved. But what I'm getting at is that when you look at the tendencies of there's a usually some kind of Hollywood connection, there's a military intelligence connection, a CIA connection, something like that. There's the usage of drugs and brainwashing, MKUltra type stuff just happens to be. There is usually some kind of pedophilia, pederasty. Again, look at the Children of God cult, right? I mean, this is what Rose McGowan, Joaquin Phoenix, River Phoenix, they come out of this cult. This is a pederasty cult run by a guy who, again, tries to put on the Jesus mask and, you know, pretend he's Jesus and whatnot. And it also has these Hollywood connections, right? And it's a commune. So we're starting to see this experimentation, this lab experiment in all of these different examples. And the same will go for Jim Jones. What does Jim Jones do? He goes down to Brazil and under the cover of different agents, NGO type agencies that have for a long time been used by the CIA, like World Vision or USAID. They're down there studying the local indigenous religions, the candomblé, the drug use by the shamans. And then they come back and they just happen to set up their cults where people are drugged. I mean, come on. But the guy he's down there liaisoning with, probably his handler, is a known CIA guy, Dan Mitrione.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's fascinating. And they know what components they need to use, right? They need to play on powerful archetypes. They need to bring in some, Christian theology, but you know, spice it up with the devil. Yeah, exactly. A little bit of this, a little bit of that, right? But and the end result is, of course, that depending on what the outcome is, it works. Or I think that they discover that yes, we can do this. Now we don't know what the goal was. Maybe it was to you just murder one and they killed several, or it was just it reversed. They wanted to try to have him kill 100 and they just did a few. That we don't know. We don't know the motivations of what they actually wanted to do. But it's enough of experimentation in social engineering for them to realize that they can upset things in this capacity. So what I believe happened, Jay, is that what happens with Manson specifically is that when you bring in not only the drugs and all that kind of stuff into it, but the combination of what they call the British invasion with all the music coming out of Tavistock, such as the Beatles and all the stuff. I mean, that's really when Manson supposedly goes over the edge. When the Beatles release their White Album, right? That's when where Helter Skelter is on. That's when he gets, I guess, all these ideas about a race war and stuff. He interprets it in that way. So something triggers in him there, and we don't know, is it the music? Is there something in there? Or is that just what happens when a guy takes, like, tons of acid, just, like, sees these things in everything and what to do? We don't know. We just don't know that.
So what you're saying is, who's the real Paul McCartney? When did Paul McCartney die?
He's dead, man. He's dead, right?
Joke. I've never even really looked into that. But what I'm saying is, yes, you're right, that Beatles have, again, at the same time as the British invasion, you have the Crowleyan invasion is one thing we could call it, because you mentioned the Scientology and Process Church. Well, where did L. Ron Hubbard learn his cult skills? Where was he before he started?
The military.
Crowley's cult, and in the military.
Yep.
So as a follower of Crowley, what I think Hubbard did was kind of take the skills that he learned there and in naval work that he did, and come up with a formula for a cult. I think that the same pattern is what happens in the rock bands. So rock bands and rock leaders are cults too. And that's what they were studying with Tavistock. That's why the Beatles are hanging out with Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, is that they're trying to figure out how they can be these icons of being a guru.
Yeah.
Now, what's the point of that? Well, it's to party and get laid, but that's not all there is to it, because there's a lot of money, there's a lot of power and influence behind these commodities, and that's what they are. And they're not just commodities to make money, they're also agents of change.
Tools.
They're cultural transition agents for a purpose, and that's precisely why Tavistock comes into play here. And it's not just Tavistock, there's all the American analogs for the exact same stuff. Rand Corporation has for decades studied pop culture, how to alter and change things and sell things through pop culture. That's what I wrote about in my book.
Yeah, I mean, and that has been the biggest change agent, if you want to call it that. That has been the method through how they transformed from a more, conservative, family-oriented culture in the 60s. And that's why this period is so interesting, because it all just explodes onto the scene at this point. America, won the Second World War, the evil guy, the Nazis are gone now. Now we can, let's party now. Let's do all these things and release the drugs and do all the stuff. And the reality is that the CIA and all these other intelligence services have an intricate role in disseminating them and starting the experimentation, starting and testing, seeing what works and what doesn't work. And I think it's partially also why they bring religion into it, is to create dedication beyond reason, right? That they need that element of faith. Yes. They need that element of like something which is simply higher than the material reality itself. And that's where that comes in.
Yeah, there was a, I'm thinking of there were magazines actually in the 70s, which I didn't know this until very recently. One of them was called Star Magazine. And what it did in the 70s, early 70s, was promote the idea of the groupie. So you had one of the predecessors to Manson, Vito Palikas. And Vito was this nutball who, oddly enough, wasn't pro-drugs. And he would actually talk about how the CIA and the government used drugs to mind-bomb everybody and to socially engineer. But he's also running his cult. So I think he knows what's going on. And he's the beginning of the groupie. He's the beginning of the Whiskey Go Go, the Doors, and these different bands are playing, and they weren't actually that good music wise. So what they had to do to bring in audiences was have a bunch of bare nested babes, bouncing around, and that's where Vito came in, is that he would bring his flock of runaways in, And so people would go see these concerts, the Mamas and the Papas, the Doors and whatnot, because Vito's bare-breasted babes were there. And this is actually what got the hippie stuff going.
This is the guy, by the way, folks, for you who are watching the video version, that's the guy Jay's talking about right there. He's British, I guess, and he is exactly as you said, which is very interesting. He was, mentioned that LSD, watch out for that, kids. It's all government and stuff. He seems to be a blueprint of certain aspects of kind of the archetype that they're developing, but then they add in their own components later, as you detailed.
Yeah, so after him comes Manson, and Manson basically mirrors Vito in all these different, cult patterns. He's got the harem, he's got the young kids. Vito was an advocate, as I understand, of pedophilia. Manson was into that. There's a definite tie into Hollywood. The Spahn Ranch, where the family was actually an old movie set. So you have Manson hanging out in the circles of Roman Polanski and the circles of the Beach Boys. It's all kind of a cauldron there from whence this brew spews forward. And what it does is more so than it being, Charles Manson is like a mind controlled assassin, which I'm not denying, the horrendous nature of the ritual murder. But what I'm getting at is that the real effect of it is culture wide, mass consciousness. That's the whole purpose of it. Because of what it does is, you'll talk to people from that generation that were there and they say, JFK and Manson, that destroyed America's innocence, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so it did achieve the social engineering trauma factor, that it was trying to go for. So that was the whole point of it. And that's why Manson, I think, is so central, is that he's one of these, he's like a sticker, that you stick on anything that you want to be basically ruined, right? So
early on,
I do think that there were, I'm not a leftist, but I do think there were some people who were genuinely anti-war and that they were trying to do this through their music. And so what they would do is with any of these Laurel Canyon creepers, weirdos, John Phillips, Mamas and Papas and Frank Zappa and these kind of people, is that they would pick out who were the real anti-war people, and that what they would do is they would thrust to the forefront somebody who was just a total hedonistic Dionysian degenerate like Jim Morrison. And so what they could do is with Manson is that anything that you want to taint to make look funky and nasty is you just stick the Manson sticker on it. Charles Manson talks about stopping the war. You're like Manson. You don't think that these wars are good. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah,
and that's a very powerful, disinformation tactic that's gone on for a long time. You talk about race? You're like that Manson guy. You have to put the Manson sticker on.
And that's literally happened just in the last few days, right? That everyone is latching onto this guy and trying to prove that their enemies is like Manson. So what some of the earlier stuff that was done by people is that, well, Manson was there to make the hippie movement seem ridiculous and silly. And as you say, maybe that was true in the beginning, in the initial stages of it. Yeah, sure. I would agree with that. Here's a classic headline, that those people have found CIA documents and supposedly they say, the hippie movement is too influential. It's changing people's perception on the Vietnam War. But what the CIA did is instead of killing it was to take it over, merge with it and control it and take it in a different direction and stuff like that. But later, as you say, and this is evidence because it's happened in the last couple of days, is that they take it into this direction where basically, Charles Manson was a white supremacist, right, with Helter Skelter and with his swastika. But, as I said earlier when we spoke, he initially had an X in his forehead, and that he converted that later over to a swastika, meaning someone is literally handling this guy and just telling him, no, go in this direction now, do this.
So he would have made the X-Men look bad, and the X-Men the X-Men are an image of gay rights. So,
there you go, exactly. Well, so, here's a video playing here where basically the discredited publication Newsweek connects Manson to the alt-right. Today the alt-right has adopted some ideas of his white supremacy. I mean, it's like so predictable. They even went further, by the way, just because of the fact that they talk about race, right? They have to be Charles Manson. But Fox News had a detail here of how one of their authors also connected it to Trump, right? He's Trump. That's like brilliant. That's what
it's... Get a huge, and a huge.
Charlie, good friend, great guy, gonna be huge.
It's ridiculous. I mean, Newsweek is tanking. We know it's fake news. It's all bullshit. But you know, for a little while, it works. You know, it works for a little while. So what do we how do we deconstruct that? That they use it in whatever way they want to. They just they create these, you know, demons and people's champions, and they just steer it off in whatever direction they want. But seeing through it is what helps, Jake. Seeing what they're doing.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the Laurel Canyon scene, and I don't mean to dwell on this too much, but it's very illustrative. You have not just the creation of this burgeoning counterculture music movement, which, again, I think there were a lot of sincere artists and musicians who, I mean, I'm not saying they were geniuses, but they probably just didn't like the idea of constant wars. What's the point of all this? And so what you have is you have a bunch of families of military intelligence people, and it's their kids who are the ones that are thrust into stardom. You know, Jim Morrison's dad is an admiral. He's involved directly in the Gulf of Tonkin incident. This is public history. But Jim Morrison would never talk about that. Jim Morrison would always say, oh, my dad's dead. His dad wasn't dead. His dad was an admiral.
Mm-hmm.
So why is it that Jim Morrison is suddenly the image of this music scene, this burgeoning culture creation scene? Well, it's because Jim Morrison is not just a kind of a nutball, but he promotes a lot of degeneracy. I mean, you watch old videos of Jim Morrison, and he's humping the speaker on stage and, you know, pulling his wanker out.
Yep.
He's opening the door. He's breaking on to through to the other side.
That's right. Lighting it on fire. Yep.
And so what I'm getting at is that these characters, I don't think that it's accidental that they were actually supported by the establishment. So like Atlantic Records, who was at this time, if I recall, run by a Turkish guy who was connected to some intelligence group, like Turkish intelligence at this time, and he somehow becomes the owner of Atlantic Records. Well, they promote like all of these counterculture people. Now, why would Atlantic Records, AM radio, Rolling, all the big magazines at the time, I don't know if Rolling Stone was out then, but all the big magazines at the time start promoting all these counterculture people who don't have any real philosophy or political bent. They're just Dionysian hedonists. And the point is that if they were truly countercultural, they would not be promoted by all of these mainstream establishment promotional figures. Time Magazine. That's another one of the big ones that promoted all these guys was Time Magazine. And that's because, by the way, Henry Luce, who owned Time Magazine, Skull and Bones guy, Henry Luce and his wife, Claire Booth Luce, were very big in promoting LSD. They actually promoted it on the cover of some Time Magazine issues back at the time. And that's because they were connected to Gordon Wasson, who went down to Latin and Central America. Carlos Castaneda was part of this too, by the way. And they were studying the indigenous religions to create the mind control shaman. So what you're looking at in these nutballs is versions of mind control shaman. I mean, Jim Morrison would talk about himself like that, like he was the shaman figure.
Yeah, the kind of a witch doctor, Dionysian, almost Loki type. You don't know if they're good or they're evil, but those properties, I think, draw people into it as well.
Yes.
Because you read everything into
deep.
It.
Yeah, they just poetry on stage.
You need to decode it, and what is it? You know, and then you're like, well, there's nothing there. You know, it's like it's just bullshit.
The snake is on the lake. Taking a break.
The Lizard King, you know, yeah. It goes on, you know, on. But one of the things, too, that's interesting that I wanted to talk a little bit about is that there is these weird connections kind of at the time as well that you know, different aspects that kind of flow into each other. For example, right, let's talk about I guess the Dakota Building in New York is a central piece in this, because it was, you know, John Lennon, he had an apartment in the Dakota. Mark David Chapman, who shot Lennon, he shot him outside of the Dakota Building, right? In the building at the time is where they shot Rosemary's Baby, which is basically about Satan's son incarnate coming to Earth. Shot
by Roman Polanski.
Roman Polanski, exactly, which is married to Sharon Tate. Who's murdered by the Manson family and the clan and the family and all that stuff. And so that's just one of these like weird kind of coincidences that just where everything kind of ties in together. I don't know if there's any thought behind this or if that's just what happened at the time, but there's many of these, many kind of weird things like that, where it seems that someone is almost like pulling the string kind of behind the scenes. And Chapman, of course, Mark David Chapman was the guy who read the Catcher in the Rye. Salinger mm-hmm. has all these connections to also to the intelligence services and stuff like that. Right. There's a movie called Chapter 27, which is pretty interesting, that details that. And 27 is the age of where all these pop stars die at, by the way, the 27 Club. You know, so there's all these weird synchronicities and kind of occult connections. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I think you're right. In fact, when you look into Mark David Chapman, he thought he was obsessed with The Wizard of Oz, and he would read everything in The Wizard of Oz kind of mythos, which again does actually pop up at times in MKUltra mind control stuff. I was finally able to verify one aspect of that, where Dr. Ewan Cameron actually did use The Wizard of Oz in a lot of his LSD reprogramming tests. And he had convinced this one woman through electroshock and through the administration of so much LSD that she thought she was Alice in the rabbit hole or whatever. So there were actual connections. That's not just a conspiracy myth. There is one that's in Mark, Search for the Manchurian Candidate, John Marks details that experiment. So what I'm getting at is that I don't know if Mark David Chapman was for sure, you know, in part of some MKUltra program, but he was, as you said, in these bizarre evangelical groups for a time, which those have, there's confirmation many of those have been created by Pentagon and military intelligence for different kinds of experimentations. Berkowitz was for a time mm-hmm. Involved in one of these evangelical groups right after he joined the military. You find that same pattern with Mark David Chapman. So, but with Chapman, it's not just the question of the Wizard of Oz. He actually had delusions where he thought that he was interacting with the little people, the munchkins from the Wizard of Oz. I'm not joking, from the Wizard of Oz. And so why that's relevant is that a guy like that with those kinds of delusions could easily be fingered and profiled and picked to be part of some kind of operation like this.
Mm.
In other words, when these people go through these kinds of military or institutional, you know, settings, psychiatric settings, the system, they're profiled and people know who the nuts are. And these wackos can actually serve a very useful purpose if you're running covert operations or black operations, because you can just, you know, pin whatever you're doing on some wacko. I'm not saying that makes John Lennon a hero. In fact, the whole thing kind of propels John Lennon into superstardom. So it could be that this makes a martyr out of John Lennon and the left. But, and again, I don't claim to know. I'm looking at both possibilities. You also have John Lennon towards the end of his life coming out and saying, "Hey, man, did you know? I've been looking into the conspiracy. They're going to kill everyone, man. They've got the conspiracy to kill everyone." So maybe they didn't like him talking about, you know, radical depopulation agenda, or maybe, you know, the so-called assassination was just a way to propel him into being a martyr. And a lot of these rock stars in the 27 Club that you're talking about, martyred rock stars or dead rock stars actually propels the mythology.
Much more powerful. Much more. They basically can't put their foot in their mouth too much at some point, right? So, again, people see them as these, literally as these heroes. So it could also probably be this issue that, they might be somewhat controlled in the early stages. It's not really that, they don't have that much of a, how do I put it, content or direction in like an ideology that they are pushing. But later, if they do wake up to some of this stuff, or even how the inside operatives work of entertainment and stuff like that, it's very beneficial to take them out at that point. And they end up making more money on them. They can turn them into these martyrs, as you say. And it's before they basically started spreading any truly dangerous ideas, truly countercultural ideas in the world.
Well, a great example is Elvis himself. Elvis was into theosophy and all this weird stuff. And Elvis became convinced, and his manager was military intelligence, by the way. I mean, his manager was a general.
That is true.
And so Elvis starts thinking he's Jesus, and he calls his managers and people apostles. I mean, Elvis kind of went nuts, and, you know, no telling what drugs he was on, too.
Yeah.
But Elvis was he's kind of the real icon, I guess you could say, of the culture creation mythos, right? Marilyn Monroe is another one of these, and she's important for transformations of views of sexuality. Then we have the next phase, which is like the Manson type, right? Which is even more bizarre and degenerate.
Yeah, exactly. And it's what do you think that they're using this for? I mean, if you just look at Manson specifically, I mean, it might have just, as you say, it might just have been the Petri dish that was the objective, the experiment in itself. It might not be that it needed to serve something. Today they can use it, as we pointed out, as a very important battering ram against any kind of movement or, you know, whatever you need to, basically. So it serves a purpose, but is there any deeper, like, is there any ritualistic nature to this, occult nature, which they somehow think they tap into or can utilize?
I would say yes, that's very likely, because some of the people that we mentioned in the background, Robert De Grinston, you know, these are people who actually were, for a time, very interested in black magic and sorcery, the dark sides of the occult and all that. So I think he may have been a handler. I don't know. But I mean, that guy's into some really dark stuff. And you do have people in the background of these kinds of operations who usually are into the occult. You know, there's obviously some cult aspect to the Zodiac killings. If you look at Henry Lee Lucas, Henry Lee Lucas claimed to have been part of the Hand of Death cult down near the border of Texas and Mexico. And it was later discovered that there actually was a kind of cult compound there, and that people were being human. There was human trafficking going on and this kind of stuff. So I'm not saying that makes Henry Lee Lucas innocent. I don't actually know what's going on. But what I'm saying is that he served a function, most likely as a kind of maybe a hitman or something like that. But in many of these cases of these so-called serial killers, that Manson, et cetera, there's absolutely an occult, dark occult ritual aspect to them. And, I mean, that goes all the way back to, you know, like the Black Dahlia case, which is quite obviously a ritual murder.
Let's get into that in a little bit. But before we do that, let's just talk about this proto. You found a case, I had never heard of it, which was kind of a precursor to Manson and many of these others. LA Weekly did an expose on this. Another suicide bomb cult, I guess, 1950s. That's early. They even have actually the one interesting note I saw right away is that you see in the backdrop on the door there, they have like a Templar cross, and there's another image here a little bit further down in the article where you can see on her kind of chest there, she has the Templar cross. And the Process Church kind of has the Templar cross, but twisted. All the arms are twisted, and it makes it, you know, look like a swastika, which, of course, Manson shows up on his forehead with eventually, too. But tell us about this other cult, Jay.
Right. This is interesting because you have this guy who also was a former military, I forget what his role was. I don't think it was military intelligence, but who starts calling himself Krishna Venta, and he starts this cult, and quite like right away, what's weird about this cult is that they're in the news at the scene of a famous plane wreck. Now they just happen to be on the scene to give all of the plane wreck people aid. I guess many of them survived. Some of whom were actually famous Hollywood people. Very bizarre story. But what this did was propel the cult to give them a lot of advertising. So this didn't become like a nationwide cult. It's one of these very specific, unique to California cults. And, you know, there's all the typical cult stuff. The guy looks like Jesus, surprise, surprise. You know, you've got young kids and brainwashing and all that kind of stuff. And, oh, you got to give the cult all your money. And then what happens is they are involved in a suicide bombing plot, which is very bizarre, which doesn't actually happen, but this spoils the cult and it goes under. But what's interesting is that, yes, this is another guy who's a proto-Manson. This is prior to Vito Paulikas, another proto-Manson cult. Again, very mixed up in big mainstream media stories, given press coverage. And then this shady plot of suicide bombing that ends the cult. Very, very bizarre. Again, like you, I'd only learned about this in the last couple of weeks, so I'm not any kind of expert on it. But even LA Weekly says, hey, there seems to be a pattern here, right? Yep. So it's not just crazy conspiracy theorists that are making the connections and seeing these patterns between how a lot of these cults seem to have something else going on beyond just what they appear to be, which I would say is probably some kind of social engineering or intelligence function.
So there's been different incarnations of this where they basically are successful, if you will, in some cases, and less successful in others, and there is a kind of a progression, basically, where they... But the epicenter seems to be California. It seems to be, you know, this particular area. For some reason, I don't know. It just, what about the Lookout Mountain stuff? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I can tell you my theory is because California is kind of, as a whole, basically a military-industrial complex state. I mean, there are hidden bases. There's more bases, and there's secret Navy SEAL bases. I mean, my dad was in the military. He was stationed in San Diego, so I know about this. Yeah, and a lot of this is just public. I'm not saying anything secret. You can look up all the naval bases in San Diego. And it is a hotbed of the creation of the cult, the alternative lifestyle. This was advertised back at, you know, 50s and 60s. Come to L.A. You know, there's a great scene at the beginning of L.A. Confidential where Danny DeVito is actually reading out some sort of promo for, like, coming to L.A. And what they were doing was trying to sell people on move out here and all your dreams will come true. You know, you'll be a famous star or whatever. And L.A. Confidential actually that's a good movie. It actually encapsulates kind of what we're talking about here a little bit prior to the cult phenomenon. This is 50s, 40s.
Could it be that it attracts a certain individual? Sorry to interrupt, Jay, but one who's basically also willing to kind of leave. They don't have those strong roots to a certain extent for some reason, right? So that they're willing to uproot and go, and those will probably be more susceptible. To being swept into whatever they're a part of, whether that's a movie industry around Hollywood or whether that's some of this military stuff or some of the occult things that are going on.
Absolutely. Oh, you're spot on. Yeah, I mean, who's going to do this? Well, the person who thinks they're going to be a movie star, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Charles Manson thinks he's going to be a rock star, right?
Yeah.
He goes out to L.A. to the Laurel Canyon scene. You know, this is kind of the point of David Lynch's movies, Lost Highway and Mulholland Drive. It's about, you know, the young girl who goes out to L.A., Hollywood, and ends up in porn or ends up a crack whore.
Yeah. Yep.
And then that's the point. Or you're in a cult, right? You end up in some crazy, crazy cult, and you're, you know, signing over your inheritance to some guy that looks like Charles Manson. So I'm glad you mentioned the Laurel Canyon scene, though, because what this shows is the Air Force had a secret studio. And then eventually it would be the CIA before it was sold off, where they were processing and working in the latest film technologies. So this is like cutting edge. This is like the cutting edge industrial light and magic Lucasfilm of its day, where they're and it's 100% totally military industrial complex operation. This is where actually the atomic bomb footage was souped up at the Laurel Canyon Studios. It was a giant facility. And all of the A-listers of the time, 50s and 60s, they actually had access to the studio. So you can actually find in that clip that we're about to see here, you're going to see Jimmy Stewart is there at Lookout Mountain Studios filming different kinds of government promos and propaganda type videos.
Yeah.
And a lot of the A-listers, Walt Disney did a lot of work at Lookout Mountain Studios, Marilyn Monroe, Cary Grant. And the point is that there's Jimmy Stewart. Oh, there's Jimmy Stewart. Worship America. They're going to fight the commies. Jimmy Stewart was actually an informant. He was an informant for the FBI.
Huh.
He's also in a movie called The FBI Story, which is about the FBI. Cary Grant also spied for, I believe, the OSS. And he tried to out Errol Flynn as a Nazi. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
Yeah,
good on you, Errol Flynn.
It's a crazy story, but wow. I think it's probably true. I mean, like the Jimmy Stewart stuff is obvious. So he's in the FBI movie with J. Edgar Hoover, by the way.
Yeah.
Anyway, so the point of all this is that what this shows is that the thesis about Laurel Canyon and Lookout Mountain Studios is not conspiracy theory or made up. I mean, you're watching them filming war propaganda footage there. So there was absolutely a 100% military industrial complex connection to the Laurel Canyon Hollywood scene. And all the A-listers, all the big people are there making movies there.
Interesting. And this was converted over later to a mansion house, which the guy who played Mark David Chapman, Jared Leto, bought.
Yeah, a couple summers ago, I went to L.A. and I went and drove up. You can't actually go on the property, but you can drive up Wonderland Avenue, of all roads.
Oh, there you go.
You have to get on Mulholland Drive.
Yeah.
And then you get onto Wonderland Avenue, and you drive up there, and you can still see there some of the old memorabilia and signs from the Air Force stuff is still there.
Mm-hmm.
But no, it's like a private residence, so it's not like you can't go inside or anything. Yeah, so there was an interesting series of facts when you look into the Lookout Mountain studio that, again, you know, not many people have been made aware of until Dave wrote, you know, Weird Scenes of Southern Canyon. And what he documented was that by 1947, the facility was 100,000 square feet. It had sound stages, screening rooms, film processing labs, editing facilities, animation department, 17 climate control vaults, a helicopter pad, and a bomb shelter. It produced 19,000 classified motion pictures, more than all the Hollywood studio system combined at that time. Officially, the facility was run by the U.S. Air Force and also produced the Atomic Energy Commission footage of the atomic and nuclear bomb tests. And then he goes on to say that 3D effects were developed here, apparently, and Hollywood luminaries such as John Ford, Jimmy Stewart, Howard Hawks, Ronald Reagan, Bing Crosby, Walt Disney, had a Hopper, Marilyn Monroe, were all given full clearance to the facility and worked on undisclosed projects. It retained as many as 250 producers, directors, technicians, editors, animators, civilian and military, along with top security clearances. So what's fascinating is that this has been going on this whole time, and that shows that this is a military-industrial complex state. The rise of Hollywood itself is intimately connected to the support and collusion with this kind of stuff with the military-industrial complex.
There's Bob Hope with this. Was it a USO armband he had on there or something? Yeah.
Yep.
All right. Well, very interesting. So there's other aspects going on here at the time. Of course, there's a subculture kind of in Hollywood. You have some of the, you know, the Satanists, the kind of, they're kind of poster boy Satanists, Kenneth Anger and LeBay and all these people that are kind of somewhat tied into this as well. Some of the film stars are hanging around these people. They're kind of getting some of their more edgy ideas, I guess, from some of these guys. How serious is this in terms of the Satanism accusations and that these people are into that kind of stuff?
Well, again, that's a great point because this is a cult, more or less, that comes out of California, right? I mean, the Church of Satan, Anton LaVey, you know, this comes out of California, San Francisco, and I don't think that church itself is that big of a deal per se, but I think that it is just another one of the examples of many cults that were started that do have high level, you know, connections. Obviously, there were many, you know, big A-listers that were involved in the Church of Satan, Sammy Davis Jr. and Jane Mansfield, for example. And some weird things happened with that kind of stuff. You know, Jane Mansfield has her bad luck car wreck, right? So, you know, a lot of weird things going on there. Some people have made a connection between intelligence agencies and the Church of Satan. I'm not sure if that's true or not, but when we look at somebody like Michael Aquino, there's obviously a connection, and he splits off of the church, you know, Church of Satan, and starts Temple of Set, and then is a fairly prominent colonel who specializes in psychological warfare.
Interesting. And then you have the Kenneth Angers, Hollywood Babylon,
right.
Lucifer Rising, and all that kind of stuff. I mean, it's that that's a subculture that seems to
exist. It is a subculture
within Hollywood,
but it's influential, and that's the thing, is that even though Kenneth Angers' movies are awful and
not that great,
because they were perceived as edgy at the time, they influenced people later on to do more. I mean, in other words, it's kind of a pushing the envelope type of thing.
I mean, yeah, exactly. I mean, that's a good point. I mean, it is, and that might be just a reason, too, why we see so much of that now especially in the music videos, they just all incorporate that. And all the personally, I'm part of also thinking that it is for the sensationalism value to it, that it does, you know, it generates clicks and views and money and all that kind of stuff. But there's something to it that they're just drawn to. And I think also that it works, and it's successful to a certain extent to draw people's attention in, because these are, you know, old ritualistic aspects and symbols and talismans and you know, powerful things that they're using in their imagery. And I think that on some level that speaks to the subconscious of man for some reason.
I think you're right. I think that's kind of the point. The pattern that we've been seeing here is that what you see with the movie director and with the production of a film, that's a kind of what in sociology is called, it's a kind of dramaturgy. A kind of liturgy drama that's enacted, played out. This is the history of Sophocles, the plays, the Greek plays, the dramas. They're a form of ritual, and they are used for the promotion of an idea or an ideology. Whether the people in the crowd know it or not, it is being used in that way. Not everything, but you know, certainly Greek dramas were used for the promotion of the ideas of the Greek state, or Athens, or wherever the plays might be going on. You know, Virgil does this with the Aeneid. He promotes the Roman state ideology through the Aeneid. So this is as old as time. And what I think is so bizarre is that it's just that when you look at this kind of Ken's anger stuff, it's like another level of degenerate. It's very, very disgusting. But it's relevant because, you know, he has, there you go, Marianne Faithful, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, he's in the circles of Rolling Stones. He's in the circles of the Beatles. And he's putting, you know, Sharon Tate in his movie. I think isn't she in Lucifer Rising or one of the occult ones, or maybe Marianne Faithful's in that one. I can't remember, but Sharon Tate's in one of them, and you know, soon after she ends up dead.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, so there's something to it. What was that other one called? Mountain, Sacred Mountain. You know what I'm talking about? That.
Well, John Orowski has Holy Mountain.
Holy Mountain, maybe that's the one. Yeah, very weird and stuff, but it's all this kind of pseudo-Masonic kind of stuff. And even, we heard Manson earlier. He didn't want to imply them in anything, but he was aware at that point that, you know, you moved in those circles, specifically probably in L.A., of Scientology, Freemasonry, you know, subcultures is all part of it, and Satanism is there as another flavor for those who favor that, I guess.
I think what you have with subcultures, and there's actually a lot of things that back this up. It's not just speculation, but what you have with subcultures is, again, kind of a test tube, kind of a petri dish, and they might allow or fund or get things going. A great example of this is also the history of punk rock. You can look at some of the interviews I've done with a couple guys, John Adams and a guy named Nino, where they're big fans of the history of punk rock. And it was the exact same thing where you had kind of had the CIA in the background funding and putting money into different types of movements just in subcultures to see what would happen. You find the same trend in the background of grunge music, actually. This ties into, you know, the death of Kurt Cobain. And I'm not trying to take a side on, like, being a big fan of Kurt Cobain. I do think he was probably killed. But I don't really care for the grunge music is what I'm trying to say. But you do have definite selection by powerful individuals to promote different subcultures. And I think not all the time, I'm not saying every single thing is controlled, but I'm saying that you can find specific evidence where this kind of stuff does change culture. Now, if anybody's skeptical, I just this last week was reading an interview with Heidi Fleiss, of all people. And this was an interview from a few years ago from somebody's book. I don't remember the name of it, but you can Google for interviews with Heidi Fleiss and find it. And what she says in that interview is that she realizes that she herself was a tool of cultural change. Now, I'm not saying that everything with Heidi Fleiss was planned, but I'm saying that she says, I realized that I was part of the normalization of the idea, number one, of cheating. And then she goes on to say, and it for me, you got the movement to the idea of reality TV, right? Yes, that's it.
Yep.
It's advice. At the end of that interview, she says that I was part of cultural, mass change in cultural perception.
Yeah, yep. It's interesting.
So if Heidi Fleiss knows that, if Heidi Fleiss knows that, don't you think social engineers know this?
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. And the reason, of course, why they... And as you say, it doesn't mean that every little movement and everything is controlled, but it means that they seek to have a finger in as many pies as possible because you don't know which flavor of pie the public is going to like. And when that reveals itself, you want to make sure that you're there and part of that group and organization, and that's just how it goes. And that's true for anything, like the stock market or, you know, whatever. You diversify your
portfolio. This is what the CIA or the MI6 have done this, for example, in the history of, in Stephen Dorrell's MI6 book, he says that what they would do is that they wouldn't have to necessarily control every single political candidate. It was that they would look and to see where the wind is blowing. And if some political group was trying to enact a coup in some foreign country, all British intelligence had to do was try to get the guy who was like the number one guy in that group and make sure he's your man. You don't have to control everything. You know, if it looks like that group is going to come to power, you know, just get their rock star.
Yeah. Yep. Exactly. Yeah, global cultural shift, she mentions, I think, in the interview there, too. Yeah, exactly. It's very interesting. And again, this is the stuff that we've been talking about, that we have engineers, social engineering ongoing to transform the world. It basically, what people need to understand is that these are tools and things that they use to transform and shape the world into their image. Ultimately, if you want to create, you know, docile, controllable individuals, you're not just going to be able to overturn all of this in one generation or in one go. You know, you need to have various different stages of this, and you want people to almost want to have these changes, right? They want to be excited about this. They want to, as Aldous Huxley say, that you learn to love your servitude, and that's what pop culture ultimately is. You know?
Yeah, the idea of agents of change is very real, and who are the agents of change? Is it all just Barack Obama's? No, it's people in pop culture. Pop culture has a lot more power than some government official or bureaucrat. Now,
absolutely.
Obama actually was kind of a pop culture figure too, so it worked for both government and pop culture with Obama. But that's gone on for a long time too. I mean, Reagan goes from Hollywood to you know, presidency. No surprise there. But what I'm saying is that you're absolutely right that there's a, it's all about understanding the creation of an image, and this is where we get into the Bernays type. So this is what Bernays studied for the Department of Defense. Bernays was for a while working at, you know, the War Department, which he renamed the Department of Defense.
Mm-hmm.
It's more powerful, to be able to figure out how to sell ideas like war. And then you watch a movie like Wag the Dog, and that's a big part of that movie is selling a war through Willie Nelson songs, right? If you remember
exactly.
The plot of the movie. And I bring that up because, again, they show us this stuff in movies all the time of how this stuff really works. I'll give you a crazy example. You won't believe me. There's this stupid comedy from 1999, 2001, somewhere in there. Josie and the Pussycats. Mildly funny. Kind of goofy. Silly. But that whole movie is about the military-industrial complex studying pop culture to alter culture. That's the plot of the movie. If you don't believe me, go watch it.
Interesting. I did not know that. And, of course, Bernays, nephew of Freud. You know, that's why you have the aspect of why sexuality has been such an important and powerful way for them to use and to ultimately control people. And that's why many of these cults kind of evolve around that. There's another kind of, you know, tie-in that they can hook people on and stuff like that. And then, of course, the other subculture in Hollywood is, of course, the pornography industry, right? Which is like, you know, it all ties into each other, basically, here.
Did you see the actress from Smallville, Allison Mack?
No.
Well, it was just busted that she was running a sex cult.
Oh, interesting. I did not know that. Oh.
So the girl from Smallville was running a sex cult, and what they were doing was she had a handler. She was out recruiting women to come be in the sex cult, and I think she recruited like 29 women. Mainstream news last week.
Interesting. Very interesting. Tell us about the Black Dahlia stuff then. Touch on that here a little bit towards the end, Jay.
Yeah, this is, I don't claim to be an expert. I just kind of know the basic ideas of the story. And then there's kind of a couple famous books, Black Dahlia Avenger, by Steve Hodell. And Steve Hodell argues that it seems to be that his dad was probably the best case suspect for who was behind this. Other books too have pointed, I came across this book, Exquisite Corpse, And the reason I bring this book in is because Exquisite Corpse ties it into the surrealist movement. And the prevailing thesis as to who was involved in the murder of Elizabeth Short in 1947. And the murder has very clear cult overtones because the body is dismembered and it's cut with surgical precision and et cetera, et cetera. The idea, and it was made into a Brian De Palma movie, which actually kind of is similar to Eyes Wide Shut, by the way. But what you see in the Black Dahlia case is somebody who appears to have had a predilection for surrealist art, and particularly the art of Man Ray. When you look at Man Ray's The Minotaur, you see a body in his artwork that is cut up in the exact or very similar form to the body of Elizabeth Short. And, you know, Man Ray, I think, if I recall, did describe himself as a Luciferian. And so Man Ray's hanging out with Salvador Dali, and he's hanging out with George Hodel. And George Hodel is who most people consider, you know, one of the key suspects, because Hodel was a backdoor, back alley abortionist. So he was a surgeon, so he had surgical precision. And he was also a convicted pedophile. And he hung out with people in the Laurel Canyon scene. He hung out with John Phillips of the Mamas and Papas, and he hung out with John Huston, who last time we talked about stars in Roman Polanski's Chinatown as the pedophile.
Right. Interesting.
So here's John Huston hanging out with George Hodel, convicted pedophile. He would have orgies, and they would sleep. He slept with his daughter, by the way. I think her name was Tamar Hodel. And he's hanging out with Man Ray. And so I think most people think that probably that's who was behind this famous ritual murder. But the reason it's so hyped up and talked about is because it's one of the clear, you know, early cases of ritual murder, which has these surrealist artwork undertones and overtones. And if you look at the art of Man Ray, I don't mean the stuff that you find on Google. I mean, like the stuff that's in this book. I mean, it's nasty stuff. I mean, this guy is nuts.
Out of his
gourd. And, but what I'm getting at is just that, you know, there's obviously some kind of occult nexus with this murder. And it's all these high level, Hollywood people that seem to be in the circles.
Yeah. Very interesting. Yeah. I saw too, you had, I guess Rose McGowan was in there in the,
she's in that movie. Exactly.
One of the latest ones. Yeah.
She comes out of one of the Hollywood cults.
Yep, she does. And now she's in another cult that's going to turn things in a different direction.
The feminist cult.
Exactly. Yeah. That's just it. All right. Well, interesting. What else? Anything else we should mention about Manson? Or, I mean, so he's dead now. Is it going to get even worse now with his kind of cult status or something like that? I mean, I doubt it, to be honest. I mean, he's just kind of a wacko, right, to most people. I mean, I know that he was... tons of women lined up, and they wanted to have sex with him, and they just love him. And you know, for some reason, that happens, and some women are like that; they're drawn to that stuff. But beyond that, which is a kind of an outlier, an anomaly, frankly, are they going to be able to continue to use him, or is the Charles Manson chapter finally closed at this point?
I'm thinking now that there's an opening for the role, I'm going to audition, and I'm not going to be as nutty, but I think what I'm going to do is have just specifically a cult for supermodels only. So we're not going to have any of these street skanks like he tried to recruit.
Up the quality.
I won't have any markings on my forehead. No, I'm joking. I'm being stupid.
I don't know what
will come of it. I think he seems to have kind of fizzled out. I mean, I know what you're talking about with the stories of people sleeping with him and whatnot, but I mean, I saw an interview a couple years ago where they were rolling Manson out talking about climate change.
Well, that has to be to discredit climate change then, right?
Or maybe he really believes that, you know, because it's all apocalyptic. You know, I mean, it's not thought out. It's just anything that's apocalyptic. You know,
well,
I mean?
It is. Exactly. And that it's all helter-skelter, right? I mean, that's what it goes back to ultimately. The shit's going to go down. It's going to all fall apart. But somehow these people are there to kind of make sure that it also happens. It's always the fulfillment of the prophecy itself, right? That the race war stuff that supposedly was encoded into the Beatles album and the song Helter Skelter was, you know, that they wrote that on the fridge, I think. They wrote pig on Tate's door, and they wanted it to seem that it was the Black Panthers movement at the time that had done these murders, right? to kind of instigate a
yeah, they conflict. They seem to think that it would kick off the race war. I guess that didn't exactly happen the way they thought it would. And then don't forget, didn't Squeaky try to assassinate somebody? Squeaky from?
I have no idea.
I think she tried to kill somebody. So I may be misremembering. But point being, I think the big takeaway from Manson and all these California cults is these are social experiments. And, you know, to whatever degree they are or aren't controlled individuals, I think that what we can see is that their impact is really part of large-scale social engineering, promotion of degeneracy, basically. And, you know, promote the whole 60s stuff, promoted rock and roll, promoted free sex, free love, all this stuff, which just revolutionized. In other words, without Manson in the 60s, we wouldn't be at, you know, Tranny, Sylvania, where we are now.
Exactly.
Count Dragula.
Right? I mean, Tranny,
we wouldn't be there without Manson and the 60s revolution.
Exactly. It's true. And people need to remember that like these people who instigated these murderous cults are those who have just continued the social engineering. And now we're at the stage that we're at, that all this stuff is just like no one is. These people are pushing this. I mean, they're not serious about this. It's not about equality and fairness and loving yourself and all that kind of bullshit. I mean, they're using whatever method they can to push through and transform culture. And they're using these, you know, victimized groups or whatever, and to let people, you know, drop the guard and basically allow the transformation of society to occur. But ultimately, that transformation is to control, and it's to dominate society and basically end up in a position where they know what's going to happen. We predict the future because we invent it and we control the world and everything is in order in place. It might seem like a big stretch and kind of weird to people, but the reality is that they're trying any method that they can right now. The victimization groups and all that stuff is very beneficial to transforming society. It's working. That's why they're pushing it.
Yeah, fake victimhood, fake guilt, all this kind of nonsense, which is all weaponized. But yes, that's key. I mean, in other words, even the mass push for gay rights, you couldn't have that without previous made up, you know, oppression and rights that had to be. It's all made up. It's all. You know, the most minuscule little group of, you know, I actually believe that I'm a ferret. I'm a ferret. I'm oppressed because you don't accept that I'm a ferret. And therefore I need government funding and I need George Soros to create the Ferret Foundation, right?
Yeah. The fur
to
transplant.
To force you to call me a, you will call me a fucking ferret.
Yeah.
If you don't.
Otherwise you will go to jail and you need to pay for my fur transplant and you know. All the rest of it.
I'm having my body elongated so that I can be a ferret.
Anything's possible, man. Just you wait until we upload ourselves to computers and run simulations. Then you can do all of that stuff. Don't worry about it, you know. Well, we'd just be a big avatar, as the movie implies, you know. All right, Jay. Well, awesome. Thank you for talking about Manson with us. Of course, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to find out more about Jay's work, jaysanalysis.com. That's the website. I see he has a post on QAnon, which is interesting. We won't have time to talk about that today, but that would actually be interesting, having you back and getting your take on that, actually, because it's been all the rave lately for some interesting reason. But
the post was a little misleading on purpose. I don't actually think that there was a guy leaking things on 4chan. But people on 4chan were messaging me. I was getting all these tweets. I got like 100 tweets the other day. And they were like, well, are you Q? Are you? And I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about. Q, Q from Star Trek? I used to watch Star Trek. There was a character named Q. What are you talking about? So I looked into it for several days, and then I tried to dig into, you know, are the Clintons being thrown under the bus? That's very possible with Donna Brazile. You talked about that. And then it looks like the Podestas are being investigated. Their lobbying firm shutting down. But does that mean that all this weird code language of Q, like we're going to have secret decoder rings or some bullshit? No, come on. I mean, it's anonymous. Why is somebody speaking in code on the anonymous chat forum?
It's a bunch of questions. That's all it is, right? It's a bunch of questions. It's like
some of them, which are good questions.
Sure, of course.
Much,
yeah,
it doesn't mean anything.
But
what I did was just try to take a realistic approach to what may be actually going on in that video, which it did pretty good. 30,000 people. in a couple of days.
Interesting. Yeah, this, as I said, it's been the latest rage lately. We gotta get into it. All right. Well, thank you, Jay. Really appreciate it. The book, of course, Esoteric Hollywood, is available through the site as well. You have your TV show. What else should we know about? Anything else going on?
I'm doing presently still a globalist books series where I've been going through the different books of globalists. Last I did Arthur Koestler's Ghost in the Machine, where Koestler lays out a lot of stuff that actually ties into what we've been talking about with the chemical biological engineering of people through food, GMOs, water, that kind of stuff. Koestler, you know, again, part of the Royal Society, Hungarian Jewish expatriate Marxist who's awarded all these awards and said how great he is by the British Royal Society. Why do they always love Marxists at the Royal Society? it's because they're promoting Marxists. And then I'll be talking, I did H.G. Wells and I did Brzezinski's books and I did, you know, Tragedy and Hope last year. So next up, what I'll be delving into is one of Jonas Salk's books. So here we have another one of these psychopathic heroes, the father of vaccines. Why does Jonas Salk write a book about killing everybody and using RNA viruses?
Interesting, yeah.
But he's the hero father of vaccines.
Yeah, supposedly, although he was just partially part of that process, but he was given the full credit for some reason. There was actually a team around him at the time. But, you know, again, they pushed these heroes out there for us, right, for some interesting reason. All right, that's interesting. And then Hollywood Decoded, obviously, as we said, I'm clicking in on that link as we speak, and that's over at Gaia as well. Is that so? It's like a season one, 15 episodes. It's all there, I guess. Is there more of that coming?
Well, 23 episodes, so they come out every week. And I think the last episode where we did Christopher Nolan films, we did Inception and Interstellar, and I don't know what the most recent releases are.
Okay, cool. Well, thank you, Jay, for joining us today. I really appreciate it. Always a pleasure having you on. Thank you, man. Keep up the good work, and we'll talk soon again.
Okay.
I hope you enjoyed the show. Help us out. Subscribe to our YouTube channel and spread the word about the show. Don't forget to visit redice.tv to see all our content, as shadow banning and censorship has begun to hit hard, as you probably know, on YouTube. We'll get on a few alternative platforms in addition to still posting to our very healthy and very active YouTube channel. You can follow us on Twitter before we potentially might be booted off there too. You know, on December, was it 14th or 16th, something like that, they have their information embargo that's going to begin against dissidents and those in the alternative media that spread unpopular truths such as those we discuss on this show. I do have a personal account on Gab, but we need to get a Red Ice account on there too. RedIceMembers.com is almost ready to go live. A huge thank you to all our awesome members that have sustained their membership with us after we were hacked. You guys are amazing and we cannot thank you enough. We'll bring you even more original, exclusive content for members once we're up and running, and work 100 times harder as an appreciation for you guys believing in us and helping us during this period. It's so inspiring to know that you guys are there believing in us and helping us in the way that you have. So thank you so much again. You can also donate to us, help us out further, paypal.me/redice. We do still need your help to be able to take care of our employees and those who make sure that we can bring you these shows, do the live shows, the Weekend Warrior, the exclusive segments, the radio shows, and the reports by ourselves and other people too. So thank you for your help and for helping us to fight against the establishment. We'll be back soon. To all our American listeners, have a great Thanksgiving, and don't give in when it comes to letting your friends and relatives tell you about how evil the pioneers, the pilgrims, the settlers were. There is a great deal of information out there that actually tells the truth about what really happened and how things were at that time. So read up on it. You know, today we're expected to take in and help all these other people, but back then, you know, no one wanted to help the Europeans, right? We were not allowed to go to safe lands to those who were religiously persecuted and everything else. Very interesting. Anyway, have a good one. We'll see you on the next one. Take care.